If Americans found dealing with Europeans, especially the warring British and French, a torturous proposition, Europeans were no less perplexed by Americans. The great dictionary maker, Samuel Johnson, had no opinion whatsoever of Americans. "I am willing to love all mankind," he said, "except an American." That, at least, is what he told his amanuensis, James Boswell. Americans were rascals, robbers, pirates, and Johnson would cheerfully burn and destroy them. Nor did the American experiment in popular sovereignty gain much applause from John Wesley, the founder of Methodism and otherwise the great proponent of free will. "No governments under heaven are so despotic as the Republican," Wesley said. "No subjects are governed in so arbitrary a manner as those of a commonwealth." And as for culture in America, well, one might as well forget that entirely. Thomas Cooper, in Some Information Respecting America in 1794, scorned American literature as nothing more than commercialism. "In America, there is not as yet what may be called a class of society whose profession is literature. Literature in America is an amusement only, collateral to the occupation of the person who attends, and but occasionally attends, to it." The French were no less dismissive. Thomas Jefferson was incensed to discover during his sojourn in Paris in the 1780s that the popular historian and economist Guillaume Thomas Raynal, better known simply as the Abbé Raynal since he had once been ordained as a Jesuit priest, had tossed off the claim that America has not yet produced one good poet, one able mathematician, one man of genius in a single art or a single science. A more serious blow, Jefferson discovered, had been landed by the formidable French naturalist, Georges-Louis Leclerc, the Comte de Buffon, whose 36-volume Histoire Naturelle took time to treat America as a barren land, degrading every species which grew in it. Jefferson was sufficiently angered by Buffon's brush-off that it provoked Jefferson to write his only full-length book, Notes on the State of Virginia. But even the Dutch had little good to say about America. Cornelius de Pauw's Philosophical Inquiries Concerning the Americans wrote that North America is so ill-favored by nature that all it contains is either degenerate or monstrous. Jefferson could take consolation from one Frenchman's very different view of Americans, and he was Hector Saint-Jean de Crèvecœur. Born in Normandy in 1735, Crèvecœur had served as an officer in the French-Canadian militia, and after France's defeat and the surrender of Canada to Great Britain, he stayed on in America, eventually migrating to upstate New York and marrying an American woman, Mehitabel Tippett. Briefly marooned in Britain during the latter part of the Revolution, Crèvecœur published Letters from an American Farmer, which, frankly, contradicted the viewpoint of Johnson, Wesley, and Cooper. "The American is a new man," Crèvecœur wrote, "and it is only because he is such a complete novelty in the history of the world that Europeans cannot see how unusual he is. Partly, this new man was a product of republican government and the abolition of aristocracy. America is not composed, as in Europe, of great lords who possess everything and of a herd of people who have nothing. We have no princes for whom we toil, starve, and bleed. We are the most perfect society now existing in the world. Here, man is free as he ought to be." But a great deal of what made the American new was the newness of the space he occupied. In Europe, vast numbers of people were crowded into a small amount of land and were labeled, confined, and organized around varying creeds, kings, and languages. In America, this proposition was completely reversed. America had an apparently infinite amount of space and comparatively few people. And as Madison had anticipated in Federalist No. 10, that vast space allowed the competing identities of the old nations and dogmas to dissolve into the pursuit of self-interest. Zeal in Europe is confined, Crevecoeur wrote. Here, it evaporates in the great distance it has to travel. There, it is a grain of powder enclosed. Here, it burns away in the open air and consumes without effect. Hence, Crevecoeur triumphantly concluded, he is an American who, leaving behind him all his ancient prejudices and manners, receives new ones from the new mode of life he has embraced, the new government he obeys, and the new rank he holds. He becomes an American by being received in the broad lap of our alma mater. It will be easy to wave away Crevecoeur's love affair with America as the passion of a convert, but Jefferson included him in his circle of correspondence. George Washington cited Crevecoeur in his constant projects for land development. Washington thought letters from an American farmer contained a great deal of profitable and amusive information respecting the private life of the Americans, as well as the progress of agriculture, manufactures, and arts in America. Even though Washington admitted that Crevecoeur embellished with rather too flattering circumstances. Benjamin Franklin had Crevecoeur elected a member of the American Philosophical Society in 1789. And any picture of Americans at the end of the 18th century, which emerges from the statistics gathered by the first national census under the Constitution in 1790, will give Crevecoeur more than a little credit for correctly understanding the newness of the new America. For we were already a people who looked like no other nation on the earth. All told, the American population in 1790 numbered just over 3.9 million. In a republic whose boundaries embraced 864,746 square miles, that meant that the United States, compared to Europe, almost felt empty. Population density in the United States was 4.5 per square mile. In England, with a population of 7.5 million and 50,000 square miles, England had a density of 150 people per square mile. Americans were not only thinly scattered over Crevecoeur's great distance, they were overwhelmingly young. At the time of the Philadelphia Convention, something close to half of all Americans were too young to remember the Declaration of Independence. The median age was 16, and life expectancy at birth was in the low 30s. White males averaged about 5 feet 5 inches in height, which made them about an inch taller than their European counterparts, and weighed in at the mid-130 pounds. According to the instructions in the Constitution, the census did not enumerate Indians not taxed, and it was not until 1822 that the New England geographer, Jedediah Morse, published specific estimates of the Indian population, which amounted to only 471,175 in more than 150 recognizable tribes. And more than half of those, some 272,270, were actually living west of the Mississippi. Americans were more or less evenly spaced into three zones: New England, the mid-Atlantic states, and the South. And fully 90% of them were of English or Scottish and Scots-Irish extraction, followed by 8% German. But one demographic group, not so evenly spread, was the mostly enslaved Africans. Half of South Carolina's population was black, and so was 40% of Virginia's. That was after subtracting the 4,000 black slaves who absconded from Savannah with the British at the end of the Revolution, along with 5,300 from Charleston when the British evacuated South Carolina, and 2,775 black loyalists who left New York with the British departure. Those who remained behind now took the struggle for freedom into their own hands. In 1781, an enslaved woman in Sheffield, Massachusetts, known as Mum Bett, recruited a Stockbridge lawyer, Theodore Sedgwick, to assist her in bringing a suit for her freedom on the grounds that the 1780 Massachusetts State Constitution had declared, "All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness." The case took all of one day for the jury to hear and find in Mum Bett's favor. A similar case was filed on behalf of a male slave, Quoke or Kwaku Walker. This time, the case worked its way up to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in 1783. "Our constitution of government," announced Chief Justice William Cushing in his charge to the jury, "sets out with declaring that all men are born free and equal, and that every subject is entitled to liberty. And this being the case, I think the idea of slavery is inconsistent with our conduct and constitution. And there can be no such thing as perpetual servitude of a rational creature." Slavery thus had its legal underpinnings erased in Massachusetts. And by 1790, there were no slaves remaining in that state. In 1783 and 1784, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Rhode Island began the process of emancipating their slaves, followed by New York in 1799 and New Jersey in 1804. The pattern for all of these abolition movements was established in Pennsylvania, where the Pennsylvania legislature adopted a gradual emancipation program in 1780. The Pennsylvania Abolition Society, whose petition to the first Congress had so enraged William Lowton Smith and other slaveholding congressmen, began aggressively litigating for the emancipation of slaves brought from other states into Pennsylvania. "But even in the southern states," wrote the Marquis de Chatelus, who served in the French Expeditionary Force sent to aid Washington in the Revolution, "even in the South, slaveholders seemed grieved at having slaves, and are constantly talking of abolishing slavery and of seeking other means of exploiting their lands. The free black population of Maryland rose from 1,800 in the mid-18th century to 20,000 by 1799. In 1782, Virginia's free black population amounted to only 1,800. But by the year 1800, it had swollen to 13,000. Manumission societies sprang up in New York, as founded by John Jay in 1785, but also in North Carolina, Virginia, and Maryland. This did not mean that, even when passing from slavery to freedom, that life for black Americans was going to be as free as it might be for the whites. Whatever other traditional restraints and hierarchies the Enlightenment had thrown off, the bugaboo of race remained stubborn and persistent. David Hume, like Thomas Jefferson, could insist that all men are created equal. Like Jefferson, however, Hume could not rid himself of the belief that Negroes are naturally inferior to the whites. "There never was a civilized nation of any other complexion than white, or even any individual eminent in action or speculations. In terms reminiscent of Jefferson's dismissal of Benjamin Banneker, the German philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote that the Negroes of Africa have never offered any example of one who has accomplished something great in art or science or shown any other praiseworthy quality. Race would always draw a line of containment, even of contempt, around black aspirations for betterment. And yet even that would be a vast step upwards from slavery. And in the 1790s, a tipping point seemed within reach, which would guarantee the elimination of slave labor entirely in the new republic. Few of these Americans whom Crevecoeur wrote about lived alone. Whether as working households or blood-related dynasties, Americans conceived themselves as parts of networks. Even slaves on plantations were governed by expectations of belonging to a household. Strangers were viewed with fear and suspicion. And popular reading in newspapers and books abounded with warnings against strollers and itinerants who would con the gullible into parting with their coins. When two English travelers arrived in Philadelphia from York in 1784, they were pleasantly surprised to have special efforts made to provide rooms for them at a boarding house. But the lady of the house warned them, "You know," as if it was a thing of common knowledge in Philadelphia, "you know that people do not like to inconvenience themselves to oblige a stranger." When Ruth and Henry Kendall appeared in Philadelphia in the summer of 1789, the clerk of the city almshouse knew who they were. The most notorious strolling ramblers, generally known from Boston to Baltimore. And that they fooled people into pitying their wretched plight and bestowing commiseration and charity on them until they moved on to their next target. Strangers were questionable. Between 8 and 9 out of every 10 Americans lived and worked in the countryside. Only about 5% of the population lived in urban centers of more than 2,500 inhabitants. Some few towns excepted, we are all tillers of the earth, from Nova Scotia to West Florida, wrote Crevecoeur. We are a people of cultivators, scattered over an immense territory, communicating with each other by means of good roads and navigable rivers, united by the silken bands of mild government, all respecting the laws without dreading their power, because they are equitable. A quarter of all town dwellers were concentrated in and around Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and Baltimore. Within these, the most obvious division was between skilled and unskilled workers, the latter being known simply as laborers. Skilled workers, or artisans, included everything from apprentice tailors to master carpenters and goldsmiths, and could usually be distinguished into three classes: apprentices who were just learning their craft, journeymen who had hired themselves out but owned their own tools, and masters who either worked for themselves or employed others in a shop. Of them all, laborers, merchant sailors, shoemakers, and tailors made up between one quarter and one half of all urban workmen. The rest were unskilled and manual workers, the working poor. There were substantial numbers of blacks in these urban centers. Nearly 1 out of every 10 Philadelphians was black. But most of them were also consigned to the lowest rungs on the economic ladder. Nevertheless, these urbanites considered themselves as unfettered and unrestrained as Crevecoeur the farmer. Johann David Schöpf, who had served as a surgeon for German mercenaries during the Revolution, wrote that the inhabitants of Philadelphia think, act, and speak here precisely as it prompts them. The poorest day laborer on the bank of the Delaware holds it his right to advance his opinion in religious as well as political matters with as much freedom as the gentleman or the scholar, for the law equally regards and deals with all citizens. Riches make no positive material difference because, in this regard, every man expects at one time or another to be on a footing with his rich neighbor, and in this expectation shows him no knavish reverence, but treats him with an open but seemly familiarity. All rank and precedence is, for the rest, the acquirement of personal worth. Rank of birth is not recognized, is resisted with a total force. Moreover, these same people, urban or rural, were acquiring an increasing say in who spoke for them politically. Even though Pennsylvania's open-ended 1776 Constitution only enfranchised free men having a sufficient evidence of common interest with an attachment to the community, this still opened up voting privileges far more widely for Americans than for Britons, where no more than 15% of the population in England and Wales possessed sufficient interest in the form of land and wealth to vote. In America, widespread land ownership in fee simple opened access for voting to unprecedented numbers of ordinary Americans. This was opened still further as state legislatures in North Carolina and Pennsylvania began adding non-landholding taxpayers to the voting rolls. For a brief moment in the 1780s, even free blacks in 8 of the 13 states could vote. By the time of Washington's re-election in 1792, 7 states had jettisoned property owning as a qualification for voting. And across the Republic, as many as 80% of white males were eligible to vote. On the national level, this growth in voting rights was muted by the electoral process. In 1792, state legislatures still chose the presidential electors, and the people only could be said to vote for a president in a very indirect way, by electing state representatives pledged to certain state electors. But even that was yielding to change. In the election of 1796, 8 of the states permitted casting a direct vote for presidential electors. The Constitution had framed a republic, not a mass democracy, but it was a republic which was becoming increasingly democratic within the Constitution's framework all the same. One category of free Americans did not have the vote, and that, of course, was American women, the solitary exception being New Jersey until 1807. Where women could vote based on property ownership. From time out of mind in hierarchical societies, women scarcely had any independent existence, either socially or legally. Married women were legally classified as femme couverte and could not be sued or sue, could not draft wills or make contracts or deal in property. Thus, the male head of a household was a miniature king, and a king or a governor or a squire was, by extension, simply a father writ large, with all of Anglo-American society in legal dependence on him. But the solvent of liberty ate away even at this most intimate and traditional restraint. Thomas Jefferson might think that American women were too wise to wrinkle their foreheads with politics, but those women thought otherwise. The Sentiments of an American Woman, announced a broadside posted in 1779 in Philadelphia, were born for liberty. In law, Abigail Adams complained, married women's property remained subject to the control and disposal of our partners, to whom the law has given a sovereign authority. But that did not stop her from acting as her husband's business agent while he was abroad on diplomatic missions, nor did it stop her from upbraiding her husband to destroy the foundation of all pretensions of the gentleman to superiority over the ladies. In a society of political equals, not to mention a republic, which was the first offspring of the Enlightenment. Marriage itself was the first institution to be reconceived. Although, as in so much else in the New Republic, it was not the model of virtuous republicanism which was pursued. If so, American women would have recast themselves after the model of women of classical Rome, which meant no equality, no natural rights, and an obligation to raise their sons as warriors. American women of the 1790s had a far more Lockean set of objectives in view. No longer would men be kings, nor would marriage be a kind of domestic diplomatic arrangement between the fathers of brides. Women began to consider themselves as the partners of their husbands, not their handmaids. And marriage itself was to be built on companionship and affection, rather than the strategic placement of heirs. No longer would husbands command their wives. As the English poet George Crabbe put it, "In one so humbled, who can trace the friend? I on an equal, not a slave, depend. What if he govern? There his boast should end. No husband's power can make a slave his friend." Judith Sargent Murray, who began a career as a woman of letters in Massachusetts in 1782 when she published a children's catechism, went on from there to write plays and produce a three-volume set of essays, The Gleaner. Murray predicted that the equality of the female intellect will never in this younger world be left without a witness. Mercy Otis Warren entered the fray over the ratification of the Constitution in 1788 with Observations on the New Constitution and on the Federal and State Conventions, and went on to publish plays, poems, and an ardently anti-federalist History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution in three volumes in 1805. The road to equal rights, property, and access to power lay through education. Female education should be accommodated to the state of society, manners, and government of the country in which it is conducted, insisted Benjamin Rush. The cultivation of reason in women is alike friendly to the order of nature and the private as well as the public happiness. Whatever Thomas Jefferson's worries about wrinkled brows, his granddaughter, Ellen Randolph, born in 1796, was studying Greek, Latin, French, and mathematics by the time she was 10, and offering her grandfather advice on natural history and art. Like George Crabbe's Arabella Rack, this reasoning maid above her sex's dread has dared to read and dared to say she read. Not the last novel, not the newborn play, not the mere trash and scandal of the day, but though her young companions felt the shock, she studied Berkeley, Bacon, Hobbes, and Locke. Susanna Rowson's Young Ladies' Academy in Boston, the Young Ladies' Academy of Philadelphia, Sarah Pierce's Litchfield Academy, and the Quakers' Westtown School opened their doors for women's education in the 1780s and 1790s, and their graduates were not shy about claiming a larger role for themselves in American life. "A more liberal way of thinking now prevails," announced Priscilla Mason in her salutary oration at the Young Ladies' Academy of Philadelphia in 1793. "And though presently," she said, "the church, the bar, and the Senate are shut against us, there was nothing in our laws or constitution to prohibit the licensure of female attorneys, much less the ministry or politics. Let us, by suitable education, qualify ourselves for these high departments." There is no evidence, however, that Priscilla Mason ever practiced law. And for all the egalitarianism implicit in women's education and writing, the most talented female poet of the Republic, Phyllis Wheatley, remained, as she put it, a mere spectator of the New Republic. She was not only female, but black, and spent all but the last years of her life in slavery in Massachusetts. For Mason, for Wheatley, for Quoke Walker, for Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur, the American indeed represented, as the Republic's motto said, a new order for the ages, but not quite new enough.